Welcome to the deep dive. You've handed us some fascinating sources today, putting us right at the intersection of probability theory and partial differential equations. Pretty cutting-edge stuff. Our mission, as you've set it out, is to really get under the hood of this paper, Small Ball Probabilities and a Support Theorem for the Stochastic Heat Equation. And it looks like, well, heavy-duty math. We need to figure out, what exactly is this equation they're studying? What's this small ball probability problem? And crucially, how did they manage to get such specific results for what sounds like a really non-standard model?
It's definitely a challenging piece, yeah. The paper really tackles the complexity you get when stochastic processes aren't, you know, nicely behaved Gaussian ones. So we'll be focusing on two main things. First, small ball probabilities, or SBP, basically. How likely is the system to stay near zero?
Okay.
And second, how they use those SBP estimates to prove something called a support theorem for the stochastic heat equation, or SHE.
Right. Well, let's start with the equation itself, the SHE. It describes something, a profile $2, changing over time, and also across space, $6. And the space here is defined on like a simple circle, right, where the ends meet.
Exactly. It's a stochastic partial differential equation, an SPDE. Think of it as mixing classic physics, like heat flow, with pure randomness. The first bit of the equation is standard stuff.
The Laplacian term.
Yeah, yeah. Frac 1, 2, partial lace, UT, XT. That's just your basic heat dissipation, how energy spreads out and smooths over time.
Got it. Like heat spreading in a metal ring.
Precisely. Then you start adding the more complex parts. There's a drift term, $T. The paper assumes it's bounded, which helps, but it's not the main source of the difficulty.
Okay.
The real twist, the core challenge, is the final term involving the noise.
Ah, the WDB. That's the space-time white noise, right? Kind of like random static hitting the system constantly.
Correct. But it's not just the noise itself. It's multiplied by this coefficient sigma.
And sigma's the key.
Sigma dollar is absolutely key. Because, and this is the crucial point, sigma depends on the solution $2 itself. It's called multiplicative noise.
Wait, so the amount of random kick the system gets depends on where the system is at that moment.
Exactly. The noise intensity isn't fixed. It scales with the current value of 6.
Doesn't that make things incredibly complicated? Why wasn't that just a dead end?
It is incredibly complicated. That's precisely the hurdle they had to overcome. As soon as the noise coefficient depends on the solution, the process stops being Gaussian.
Ah, okay. Gaussian processes are the nice ones in probability, right? Defined by mean and variance.
Exactly. They have a lot of structure we can exploit. But this self-referential noise term, sigma tick XU, it breaks that structure immediately. Even if you start simply, like the paper does for its main SBP result, with 20 being zero everywhere initially.
The zero profile, right?
Yeah. As soon as time tie starts, boom, it's non-Gaussian. Because the noise strength instantly depends on the tiny fluctuations of two.
Okay, so we have this messy, non-Gaussian thing evolving from zero. Let's move to the core question then. Small ball probabilities, SBP. What's the basic idea? Why is this important?
SBP is about asking how likely it is for the process to stay, well, small. We're looking at the probability XT epsilon. If epsilon is really tiny.
Like incredibly close to zero.
Right. We're asking, what's the chance that this random profile dollar stays confined within that tiny epsilon neighborhood of zero for the entire time period, $2, despite all that random noise pushing it around?
Oh, so it's kind of the flip side of looking for large deviations, where you ask how likely it is to go really far away.
Exactly. Large deviations ask about escaping. SBP asks about staying put. And historically, yeah, the sources say SBP is often technically harder to get a handle on than large deviations.
Okay. And for standard things like Brownian motion, this SBP stuff is pretty well understood using tools from people like Donsker and Varadhan.
Yes, for Gaussian processes, there's a rich theory, often connected to large deviations. But here's the rub.
Our Ishii isn't Gaussian because of that multiplicative noise, that sigma depending on 2C.
Precisely. So all those nice techniques that worked for, say, linear SPDEs or even the stochastic wave equation in some contexts studied by others, they don't directly apply here.
Because the noise isn't just an independent input anymore. It's tangled up with the solution itself.
That's the core difficulty. It takes us way out of the standard Gaussian framework. The real achievement of this paper is finding a path forward despite that non-Gaussian nature to get quantitative bounds.
Okay, let's get to those results then. Theorem 1.1. Despite this non-Gaussian challenge, they actually came up with concrete bounds for this small ball probability.
They did. They pinned down the rate at which this probability shrinks as epsilon, the size of the ball, goes to zero. They found both upper and lower bounds, and crucially, both are driven by the same kind of exponential decay.
And that decay involves epsilon 6.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty dramatic.
It is. The bounds look like C dollar over my dollars on the low side and C dollar and C dollars on the high side. The key part is that epsilon 6 on in the exponent.
Let's unpack that epsilon 6. Forget the exact constants, the olive, for a moment. What does that sixth power mean intuitively?
It means the probability drops off extremely fast as you demand more precision. Suppose you want the solution to stay twice as close to zero. You replace epsilons with epsilon 2,2.
Okay.
Because of the epsilon 6 in exponent, that makes the probability roughly the power of 26 Delzer dyes smaller, and $26 is $64.
Wow. So wanting it to be just twice as close makes the event exponentially, like 64 times rarer in the exponent.
Exactly. It quantifies just how violently the solution wants to escape that tiny neighborhood around zero due to the noise. It's a very precise measure of the system's small-scale volatility.
That's a really sharp result from such a complex system. Now, how does knowing this SBP help them prove theorem 1.2, the support theorem? What's that about?
Right. The support theorem is a key application of SBP estimates. Essentially, it tells you about the range of possible paths the solution dollar can take.
Okay.
The theorem shows that the set of all possible solutions X null generated by this random equation is dense in the space of nice, smooth functions.
Dense means, basically, it can get arbitrarily close to any target path.
That's right. If you think of any smooth, predictable trajectory, Ek-1 Udof, maybe some specific pattern of heating and cooling, you imagine the support theorem says there's a positive probability that the actual random solution, all dollar, will follow that path as closely as you like.
Provided you start reasonably close, I think the theorem mentioned.
Yes, provided the initial condition, $2, is already close to the start of your target path, all to alls. But the point is, the system's randomness is rich enough to potentially mimic any smooth behavior. It shows the equation generates a vast range of possibilities.
That is quite profound. Okay, But the real magic seems to be how they derived that epsilon rate in the first place. That's what really sets this apart.
Yeah.
Let's get into the toolkit they used.
Absolutely. This is where they couldn't rely on the standard Gaussian playbook and had to, get clever. The core idea was to use the Markov property of the SHE.
The Markov property, meaning the future only depends on the present, not the whole past.
Exactly. That property lets you break down the problem over the long time interval of dollars into smaller, more manageable pieces. They essentially turned a continuous time problem into something more like a sequence of steps.
Okay, so they chopped up time dollars. How small did those time steps need to be?
This is the crucial scaling insight. They found they needed to look at time intervals that were really short, specifically on the order of epsilon 4-1.
Epsilon to the fourth power. Why that specific scaling?
It comes from the interplay between the time evolution and the spatial diffusion governed by the heat equation part. That scaling, delta approx epsilon 4-1, is precisely what's needed to isolate the behavior within one tiny step, relating it back to the desired spatial precision epsilon.
Right. Okay. And what did they figure out about the probability of success staying with an epsilon in just one of those tiny epsilon four-order steps?
They showed, and this still required careful analysis, that the probability of staying within epsilon during one such tiny interval is roughly epsilon 2. That epsilon 2 dependence is somewhat more standard for very short-time diffusive behavior.
Ah, I think I see where this is going. This is smart. So the whole time interval is $2. Each successful step takes about epsilon 4-4 time.
Mm-hmm.
So the total number of these tiny steps you need to string together to cover the whole interval is roughly 2 epsilon 4 4, which is proportional to epsilon 4.
You've got it. You need about epsilon 4 successful steps.
And because of the Markov property, you can sort of treat these steps as independent trials.
Roughly speaking, yes. The probability of succeeding across all the steps is like multiplying the probabilities of succeeding in each individual step.
And when you multiply probabilities, you add the exponents. So you take the exponent from one step, which is like silicon epsilon 2.
And you multiply it by the number of steps, which is proportional to epsilon 4.
And 2 times times epsilon 4 gives you an exponent proportional to epsilon 6.
Exactly. That's how the epsilons emerges. It's a result of scaling the short-time epsilon 2 behavior over the epsilon number of intervals needed to span the full-time dollars. This Markov property combined with the scaling is the key innovation.
That's a really elegant way to bypass the non-Gaussian problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, were there other technical tools they needed? You mentioned Gersonoff's theorem earlier.
Yes. Gersonoff's theorem for SPDEs played an important role in simplifying the argument. Remember that drift term, $2?
The one that wasn't the main problem, but still there.
Right. Gersonoff provides a way to mathematically remove that drift term by changing the probability measure. It lets them prove the result first for the simpler case where G allers are dollars, and then use the theorem to show that the same type of bound holds even when the bounded drift dollars is present. It basically handles that extra complexity.
So it's like a mathematical trick to temporarily ignore the drift, solve it, and then adjust the answer back.
That's a good way to put it. And the other technical point was about the spatial domain, that circle of length doers. They use scaling arguments to relate the problem on $0 back to a standard domain like $0.101.
Makes sense. Does that scaling affect the result?
It does. It affects the constants and the final bounds. Specifically, things like the Lipschitz constant of the noise coefficient sigma bag get modified by factors involving $2.
Ah, so the final formulas for the bounds, those C-dollars, C1, C2, C3 constants, they implicitly contain information about the size of the domain doodles and how wiggly the noise coefficient sigma is allowed to be.
Exactly. It shows how the physical setup, domain size doodlers, and the specific nature of the noise function influence that epsilon 6 rate. It's the cost of making the result concrete for a specific spatial setup.
Okay. So wrapping this up, what's the big takeaway for you, the listener? This deep dive shows, I think, a really impressive journey through some very tough non-Gaussian territory in SPDEs.
Yeah, they use some core probabilistic ideas, the Markov property, clever time scaling to get past the limitations of standard methods. And they ended up with these really concrete quantitative bounds. That epsilon 6 tells you something very specific about how this system behaves near zero.
It really quantifies the volatility at small scales.
Definitely. But here's a final thought for you to ponder, something that builds on this work. While the authors successfully found these bounds involving epsilon 6a, they explicitly mentioned that finding the exact small ball constant,
meaning the precise number dollars the dollars, such that the log probability divided by T's epsilon 6a actually converges to dollars dollars.
Exactly that. Finding that precise constant, which would give the exact asymptotic rate, is still an open and apparently very difficult problem for the specific non-Gaussian equation.
So they found the rate epsilon 6, but the exact coefficient multiplying it in the limit remains elusive. Something still out there for mathematicians to chase.
Precisely. A challenge waiting perhaps for new techniques or insights.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. Thank you for walking us through that complex source material, and thank you for joining us on the deep dive. We hope this gives you a clearer picture of the fascinating dynamics hidden within these stochastic equations.